Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host. And I'd like to ask you, do you have friends or family who have become forgetful, maybe very forgetful? And there's a whole world out there of people who are basically losing cognition in a world that doesn't always understand that and doesn't know how to see it in a larger perspective. And so in order for us to have that larger perspective, is a wonderful doctor. We've had done shows before. We're friendly, and I really enjoy talking with him. And he's written a book called Dignity for Deeply Forgetful People: How Caregivers Can Meet the Challenges of Alzheimer's Disease. And dignity is a very big word, because it holds the forgetful people in much more grace and love. And we need to do that. And so, Stephen Post, welcome back to Energy Stew. I'm so excited about your book. I loved every part of it. There's so much. It's so comprehensive. It has so much for everybody about what it all means and how to do a better job doing this.
Well, it's a pleasure to see you again, Peter. I greatly cherish your wisdom and your insight, and I'm looking forward to a very deep and probing and meaningful conversation.
Oh, good. I'm excited to be challenged that way. And because I really believe in that we need to understand that material cognition is not all there is. That if we can actually, because I'm very spiritual, if we can actually identify the spiritual nature of people, we don't have to expect them to know what we know.
May I respond to that? It's sure. So much at the essence of this book. We so overestimate linear rationality. We think that people count under the protective umbrella of do no harm, that they are worthy of our benevolence because they can lay down thoughts and operationalize them into the future. So that kind of doing is what we think of as essential to being human, and possibly economic productivity attached to that, independence and so forth. But this book makes much more out of symbolic rationality, that you can take someone who is deeply forgetful, like my old friend Clint, who worked in the steel mills on the west side of the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland. He became deeply forgetful, and to his dying day, he clutched his cowboy hat. He even took showers with it, and we had to twist it dry.
What's interesting, he might not have even remembered his own name, but he knew right. His cowboy hat.
That's exactly right. So and that's what's important. He had the rationality of who he was in light of those symbolic factors. He had the reasoning that could identify him in terms of his life narrative, even though he didn't have procedural rationality, but he had something that was really even more important. And so many people, I talk a lot about this in the book, people who would clutch a rosary bead at the very end of their lives and still pray the Our Father, or people who would grab a Torah and remember, things would come to mind. And de Kooning, the great artist, 14 years, he had probable Alzheimer's. Exactly what Alzheimer's is another conversation, but he did have a progressive dementia. He was diagnosed at Cornell Weill. And for 13 and a half of those years, he lived in a loft in the village. And he would sporadically rise up and dip his brush in acrylic paint, go up to the easel, and he would paint. And you know, his earlier stuff, all of his material from the 50s and 60s and 70s, it's so full of anxiety, and it's almost violent in its nature. But then when he becomes deeply forgetful, he's painting a little bit more like Georgia O'Keeffe, you know, beautiful sweeping petals. And there was a posthumous exhibit, you know, that the critics said, this makes a mockery of de Kooning. But the one I liked said, wait a minute, this is a fellow who had dementia. They use the word dementia. I tend to shy away from it. And he knew who he was by virtue of his painting until nearly the very end, and probably at the very end. So this is what's really important, is that you can't say that people are gone, they're a husk, they're empty, they're a shell. There are communication issues. There are a lot of different issues that come up, some of them behavioral, but we can never say that grandma's not there.
Right, and I think that's the big thing, is to know what in grandma is the eternal nature of her in this life that is present, and that she is very aware in the moment without being cognitive,
right?
In, you know, no perspective at all, but it's kind of like be here now, and a lot of people try to be that way, and all you have to do is become more forgetful and you're going to be that way.
That's a wonderful point. And I affirm that in the book at various points, you know, that everybody's talking about living in the now. And when you have deep forgetfulness, you can't navigate so much into the future. So you are in the present. And if someone's going to be with you and acknowledge your life and be present with you, they also have to be more or less in the now. So it's in that sense, not the worst thing in the world. I don't want to trivialize anything, don't get me wrong, but you have to see these individuals not as demented. I don't like the word dementia, because it's a very neurological medical term, and it means simply a decline from a former intact mental state. And therefore, it opens the door to a lot of very negative metaphors.
Well, to judgment.
It's a judgment. It's a judgment. Yeah, it's them versus us. So then you hear people saying, well, they're gone, they're absent. Politicians will talk about their adversaries as, well, she's demented, you know.
Well, in your book, you actually have a letter from Ronald Reagan when he found out he had Alzheimer's. And you know, because there is a decline, of course, of cognition, but that's what those of us surrounding these people identify with. And we have to change our point of view.
Yeah. Absolutely. And so I talk a lot about the problem of, and this is a neologism that I actually coined in about 1994 at Case Western Medical School when I was giving a lecture to the med students. We identify with hypercognitive values.
Right. How smart.
Yeah. How smart are you? And of course, these are medical students, you know.
Right.
They're pretty smart, but we miss the point, which is that we should value consciousness itself. And someone can be deeply forgetful, and they can enjoy the smell of an apple pie, or the cool breeze in the fall, or the color of the fall leaves. That does not take linear rationality. It's almost a mystical thing. So deeply forgetful, you know, when you think about people who are in deeply meditative states, they tend to forget about the past, and not that it's entirely gone, but they're moving away from linearity. They're not anxious about the future.
Well, there are times until they get even more advanced, there are times where they're anxious about their loss of cognition.
Yes.
Until all of a sudden they reach a point where they forget that they have this loss.
Yeah, so the one thing I say in the book is if there is a kind point in the progression of dementia of the Alzheimer's type or any type, it's when people forget that they forget.
Right.
And then they can have a better adjustment.
It frees them, sure. Because yeah. There is so much worry. And I think it's important that this book can help people who find that they're becoming more forgetful to appreciate themselves more at that deeper spiritual level.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And they can appreciate themselves and we can appreciate them. I mean, they are in the early manifestations of deep forgetfulness, aware of certain losses. And that can cause a lot of anxiety and even depression.
Sure.
Because they feel that somehow or another they are now...
They identify with the loss.
They identify with the loss. But there is something really quite remarkable. I knew a guy. There's a lot of vignettes in this book. I knew a guy in Shaker Heights, Ohio. I lived for 20 years in Shaker Heights. It's an inner ring suburb of Cleveland.
Right.
Raised our kids there. And this guy was amazing. He had a reputation in the neighborhood for being pretty aggressive and pretty mean-spirited. He became deeply forgetful. And suddenly something blossomed in him. He flourished. He actually became kinder. And his family members at a focus group all testified to this. And indeed, he would ride in a van to the elder healthcare center with other people in his condition in the seats behind. He would ride shotgun and he would get out and he would very gently and wonderfully escort them into the elder healthcare center. So he discovered that he could be free and happy by helping others. And most of his life, he had succumbed to that negative myth, I don't do nothing for nothing.
Well, then again, I love that. And there are many people who, because I was talking to a guy recently who has been caring for his forgetful wife for 10 years.
Yeah.
And but he was telling me about someone he knew years ago who was the nicest guy and always friendly and helpful. And then he became forgetful and all of a sudden had a nasty attitude.
Yes.
So that, so it can work both ways. And so there's a lot in your book about caregiving and what it takes and how to deal with so many different things. But also what I liked in the book is it talks about local Alzheimer's associations in different places that can be helpful and even provide volunteers. And so people aren't alone having to deal with difficult, forgetful people.
I'm a big believer in voluntary associations and support groups. There is a little section in the book about what went on in Nazi Germany in 1939. There was a program called Tiergestrasse 4. It occurred in Munich. Basically, the Nazis had determined that people with dementia were a life unworthy of life. They were useless eaters. This was this strict.
They didn't like the Jews either.
They didn't like the Jews either. Absolutely not. And so they took about 70,000 individuals out of asylums. Some of them had developmental cognitive disabilities. Some of them were old and had deep forgetfulness. And that's where the hypothermia research began. So they put them out in the ice. They would put them in the snow. And then they would bring them back into the asylum and try to thaw them out at different temperatures and in different mediums.
Oh, that's torture.
Horrifying. And even and the thing is, these people were not Jews. They were not gypsies. They were not gay. They were not people of color. They were actually, if you will, blue-blooded Aryans, but they had one thing going against them. They were deeply forgetful. And so even at that time, the German people revolted against the T4 project, and it was ended after about 18 months. And the two psychiatrists actually who were in charge of T4 went straight to the death camps of Dachau and Auschwitz, and they inflicted their hypothermia research on the Jews.
They kept it up.
They needed a new subject pool. And you know, this was just horrible, but it's instructive to remember that some of the worst moments in the history of medicine began in the complete maltreatment of individuals who, you know, were still present and were still, in my view, worthy of our respect, but they were deeply forgetful, demented, and that meant that they were disposable and could be tortured.
Well, I mean, that's extreme, but our society needs this book because we need to have much more respect for people who can't keep up.
Right, exactly. And that's why I wrote it. I wrote it with that particular idea in mind. And so how caregivers can meet the challenges of Alzheimer's disease, the first thing is just don't give in to these hypercognitive values, although it's very hard to separate yourself from them because they are so dominant. But look, you know, Immanuel Kant, John Locke, all the great philosophers, they say it's that linear rationality that really gives a person moral consideration. So I was in Bangalore, India, about 5 years ago. You'll like this. And in Bangalore, they have the Indian National Institute for Advanced Studies. And they do a lot on consciousness there. So I was invited to do a plenary address on the concept of deeply forgetful people. And I talked about all these things. And the room was, of course, full of Hindu philosophers, Hindu neurologists, and they all agreed. In fact, the most distinguished philosopher in all of India, I won't give his name, came in and he heard me at the end of my talk and he put his hand down on the table and he said, yes, there's no reason to think less of somebody because they are deeply forgetful. No reason at all. They still have consciousness. And, you know, in the Buddhist tradition, but in the Hindu tradition as well, there is something called the Akashic reality, that our selves, our histories, our narratives are never lost, but they are somehow eternal. And it's kind of like I've got a desktop computer in front of me here. My desktop computer doesn't remember all the things. It's actually in the cloud.
Right.
So are we.
Yeah.
So we are in the cloud. I mean, that's the basically the Hindu and the Buddhist perspective.
Right.
So we are in the cloud. And that's why, you know, where the whole idea of the one mind, I mean, all of Larry Dossey's stuff comes into this, you know, premonitions, the fact that we can be more connected than we realize because our minds are part of a one mind.
Right. So beyond this third dimensional reality, time is not rigid. And it's useful because we do have to have sequence.
Yes.
But the universal computer is is not based on time. It knows about time, but it's not trapped by it as we are.
That's right. I'm going to read a quote. That's why I'm getting my phone out here, but absolutely not trapped by it. And I think that this is something that we have to work very hard at. We have to change our culture and make room for deeply forgetful people. And also, you know, I mean, there's a chapter, Is Grandma Still There? And I go into a real serious neurological conversation about this idea of memory being more than matter. And all the great spiritual traditions tell us that, and many philosophers today do not think that mind is simply derived from matter, from cells, from tissue, and so forth. It's a kind of an even split, even among the neuroscientists. So when I was at, I'm a University of Chicago guy, pretty much through and through, I'm really a Hyde Parker. And I got to work with a fellow who'd won the Nobel Prize in neurological physiology. And his name was John Eccles, otherwise known as Sir John Eccles. And he was great. And actually, this is his picture on my cell phone.
Well, most people are on audio for us.
Yeah, they're on audio.
There will be video on YouTube about
this. But let me read this. This is what he said. This is a man who won the Nobel Prize and discovered pretty much everything we know about the synapse, the whole idea of neurotransmission and so forth. He said, I'm quoting, "I maintain that the human mystery is incredibly demeaned by scientific reductionism, with its claim in promissory materialism to account eventually for all of the spiritual world in terms of patterns of neuronal activity.
Wow.
This belief must be classed as a superstition."
Whatever you think, it's there are going to be naysayers about everything.
There are, yeah. And then he finishes up. He says, "We have to recognize that we are spiritual beings with souls existing in a spiritual world, as well as material beings with bodies and brains existing in a material world." That's Sir John Eccles, who had a lot of influence on me when I was a young man. And I take all the neuroscience very seriously. I study it, I lecture about it, but metaphysically, I'm not committed to materialism. And that's why in the book, you know, there's the term that I actually coined, and there's a lot of neologisms in this book, paradoxical lucidity, different than terminal lucidity, which is like, you know, the very last moment somehow people have insights. But along the process of quote unquote decline, you have to be open to surprises, because people will suddenly be more insightful. They might even call your name, and you can prompt them with personalized music. You can in Brooklyn, they have the Memory Disorder Center. They have Alzheimer's poets, and they'll take 20 or 30 people who are really quite forgetful and incommunicative. And the poets will, with animation and spirit, they'll sing out The Road Less Traveled. And, you know, 80, 90% of the people in that room will get animated. They'll start showing physical animation. They'll begin to remember lines. And a fair portion of them will chime in for whole stanzas.
That's amazing. And you have, in your book, you talk about the enduring self.
Yes.
And there are more than 10 different ways that people can find that awareness in people through sounds, musical, tactile, smells, you know, symbols like the cowboy hat and rhythms. Because they're deeper in people's psyches.
Yes.
And so it's not just in their cognitive brain. And so, but I think this book is very important. People really need to read it for so much of this. And hopefully we can do a show more instructional for the caring, for people who care for the forgetful. And, you know, because I think what there's so much here that everybody needs to know, not just people who are told that they're about to lose their memory, but also for the people who are going to be taking care of them and what to expect. And there's so much in your book about people who contemplate suicide, and things for safety. For instance, this guy was telling me that his wife would just wander out. She'd figure out how to get through the door and just go out on her own and get lost. And they'd have to go find her. And they found a way to stop it. All they had to do was they put down a black mat in front of the door, just a mat. Uh-huh. It was black. And she thought it was a hole in the ground and she wouldn't step into it.
And so there you go.
She never went out the door again.
That's architecture and interior design is very important.
Right. So we can get, you have so much experience with so many groups and people and support groups that you've heard everything. And have so much advice for people. And so I'd like to, find time that we can look at some of the ways that you can really help people do a better job. And let's also remember that the reason they're doing a better job is because of love. And so it's the opportunity to live in a loving, dedication. And I've known people who've done that with family that have dedicated their lives to care for the forgetful. And they are, and I'm just so impressed with their love.
Absolutely. It comes down to love. And, there's a story there about Joe Foley, to whom the book is dedicated.
So we only have about a minute left of the show. Okay. So hopefully.
Very quickly, we went to, Mount Vernon, Ohio, to a geriatric psychiatric institute. And we noticed that these wonderful Hindu nurses and nurses aides were taking such meticulous care of deeply forgetful individuals. And we asked them why. And they looked at us and they said, namaste.
Right.
They were honoring the divine in the deeply forgetful.
I love that. Yeah, that's so beautiful.
That's what we need to do.
Yeah, but it takes the divine to know the divine, and the work you're doing is divine. So thank you so much for everything, your book and your dedication to this. And thanks for being a guest on Energy Stew.
It is such a delight. Thank you for having me.
And people can find more that you're doing where?
Well, the book is just, Amazon, Dignity for Deeply Forgetful People.
Right.
But my website is Stephen with a PhD post at,
Stephen G Post.
StephenGPost.com.
Okay.
Yeah, that's all. Sorry, okay. I'm getting forgetful.
Wonderful.
A little forgetful.
Good. All right. So on that note, thanks. We're all doing our best.
Yes. It's so a much, continuum. Stephen. It's a spectrum. It's a continuum.
Right. And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at PRN.live. I can be reached at Peter at HeartRiver, HEART River.org. I'd love to hear from you. And thanks so much for listening.